Hello, and welcome to the Family Histories Podcast, the show for and about those of us who are sat quietly in libraries, archives, and spare rooms all around the world, tirelessly piecing together our collective social and family history. My name is Andrew Martin, I'm a family historian, and I'll be your host. In this episode, The Knitter, we'll be hearing about a woman whose origins were kept quiet until her 80s, when they unexpectedly unraveled, and will be on the hunt for an Irish couple before and after two 19th century Scottish censuses. So, put down that old tithe map, grab a cuppa, and let's meet our guest. My guest today is a genealogist with more than 40 years research experience. He's an author, a lecturer, he was awarded a fellowship of the Society of Genealogists, and he's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. And you've probably read one of his many articles in Family Tree magazine. He's also a former principal family history specialist of the National Archives, and more recently he's been setting the record straight with his research series on YouTube. So, before he wanders off back into the depths of an archive, I should introduce my guest, Dave Annell. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the Family Histories Podcast.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you. And thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this today.
You're very welcome. I think that's possibly the longest introduction I've done for a guest because you've achieved so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I always, when people introduce me when I'm doing talks for family history groups and I hear all this stuff, I sort of look around and I sort of think, who are they talking about? It doesn't quite sound like little old me, but perhaps that's false modesty. I'm not sure.
Well, normally I start with the same question, but I'm actually going to break my own routine here. And my first question to you simply is, do you ever get time for holidays?
Oh, dear. Well, yes, I do. But the holidays tend to be tied in with family history research in some way or another.
I knew it.
You know,
You
go somewhere, you go to somewhere in the other end of the country, and the first thing you do is, oh, there's a church with a graveyard over there. So you just take a little wander around and see what there is. And there's
off you go.
There's always a connection, either if it's not with my family or with my wife's family, it's some research I've done in the past. I remember I did a research to family that lived in that little village over there, so I'll just pop in and see what we can find. So
wow, you really are obsessed.
That's one word for it. Yes, definitely.
So I think perhaps we should find out what it was that first got you obsessed or interested or dedicated, whatever the term should be, in researching your family history.
Well, I think there were a number of factors. I've always been interested in history from my sort of fairly early childhood, and it was my favourite subject at school. And one of the things that always attracted me about history was in those days we're talking about the distant past, history was very much about kings and queens. Yeah. And I loved the family trees. I was really fascinated. I think I'm quite a visual learner, so it was family trees and maps that really appealed to me. So I was interested in that. And then, I don't know, there were a couple of other little things in my life, and there were programs on television that interested me, where it was the family side of it that I was particularly attracted by. And then there was one particular incident that I can definitely remember, and this must have been about 1979, so I was 18 at the time. And my Uncle Tom was coming to stay with us, and I'd known Uncle Tom all my life. He was one of those characters, a relative that you know.
Right.
And I remember thinking and even saying to my mum, well, who is he? Because he's not your brother, Mum, and he's not Dad's brother, so how is he our uncle, you know? And she... it was fantastic that she did this. She sat down and she helped me draw out a little family tree, and I still have that family tree, actually.
Oh, nice.
And she explained to me, visually again, how he was related, and it turned out that he was my granny's cousin, and it's a big Irish-Scottish Roman Catholic family in Edinburgh. So you called people uncle and auntie even when they were quite distant relatives. So that's what really, I think that was one of the key things that got me started, made me sort of think, you know, who are all these people that I've heard stories of and that we meet every now and then, and how are they all related? And I loved that family tree part of it. That was the key thing that I could see it visually in front of me.
Yeah. So if you had your mother helping you with drawing this family tree and you had this Uncle Tom coming to stay, was this kind of sudden discovery of family trees and researching, did that kind of trigger a whole load of relatives to come and help you? Or
I think it did. It certainly encouraged me to ask questions more. So I was suddenly, when we went, we used to go up to Edinburgh once or twice a year, and that's where all the relatives were.
Right.
And I would just start asking people a little bit more about, you know, how are you related? How is this person connected? And so yeah, that, and then it sort of went from there into doing proper research, into archival research. I mean, I'm not for a moment suggesting that talking to your relatives isn't proper research. It absolutely is proper research. But you know what I mean? I started looking at documents and going into to register house in Edinburgh and feeling a little bit out of place. It's quite an intimidating building. And when you're an 18, 19 year old youth, it's, you're not really the sort of person that's normally expected to be in these places.
So no. I
felt slightly out of place, but, it's a great experience, really.
Did you also have things like family documents and photographs that you could turn to as well?
Well, yes, although I didn't really come to them until quite a lot later. My grandma, who we'll hear more of later, and my granny, so my grandma's my dad's mum, and my granny was my mum's mum. They were both inveterate hoarders, which is obviously wonderful from a family history point of view.
It is, yes.
Yeah. When they both died within a couple of years of each other in the early 1990s, I inherited their boxes of documents and photos, and I've got fantastic collections of them. Of course, wouldn't it be wonderful if I'd sat down with them and gone through all these photos and worked out who everyone was? And I didn't, but I'm gradually getting there and reconstructing these photos and trying to work out who everyone is.
Wow. So whilst you're in the archive, do you think that there's an underrated record type?
That's an interesting question. I don't. I always talk about wills as the most underrated source for family history, because everyone uses the census returns because they're so easy to access online nowadays. Mm-hmm. Everyone uses birth, marriage and death records, parish registers, etc. But there seems to be this assumption from some people that wills aren't for them, that their ancestors didn't leave wills. And I suppose when you look at your average 19th century agricultural labourer or your worker in the cotton mills, probably not going to have left a will, but their grandparents might have, their great-grandparents might have, and so on. As you get back into the 18th, 17th century, more people are more closely connected to the land. I think there is a better chance of finding wills. So I would probably rate wills as my main underrated records.
What do you think is your favourite part of researching?
It's the detective aspect of it, really. It's the going from the unknown to the known, from cracking these problems that, you know, I don't know, just using a variety of sources to get to the truth, as far as you can ever get to the truth in these things. So you're not just saying, right, I'm going to look at this record. I'm going to say, I've found this record. Now, what does this tell me? What other records can I look at as a result of having found this? And where is it going to lead me? And it is that eureka moment where, you know, I did something very recently, when going back to the photos we were talking about before. I've got these wonderful photos of my dad as a young lad hanging out on the streets of Edinburgh with his mates. And there's this one particular photo where he's posing on a motorbike and, you know, he's looking really cool.
Okay.
And his mates are on. It wasn't his bike and it wasn't his mate's bike. I think it was their older brother or their dad's bike or something. But he's posing on it and he's in front of this house. I wanted to know where this photo was taken because I like to know things like this. And I noticed on the house there's this sort of brickwork pattern, and it's quite distinctive. It's sort of a mixture of very dark, occasional very dark bricks and mainly quite light ones. And I knew approximately where the photo would have been taken, quite close to where he lived. So I got onto Google Maps the other night and I was just going up and down the streets, and I saw this house and I thought, well, that looks quite good. That looks quite convincing. And as I zoomed in on it, you could see that the pattern was absolutely identical. There was no question whatsoever that that photo, taken in about 1950, had been taken outside that house. So yeah, I mean, it's not a great research breakthrough, but I love that sort of detective, the detail of it all, you know.
Yeah, just kind of thinking around the other ways to solve that, because I guess there was no identifying writing on the back, because otherwise you'd have used.
Oh, of course so, not. Yeah. No. Yeah. Why would people do helpful things like that?
Yeah. Oh dear. Well, clearly, as an 18-year-old in an archive, you were not deterred from going into archives. So, How did you end up working for the National Archives?
That's quite a long story. I mean, I started off, I worked in retail when I was, you know, after leaving school. I worked in a bookshop in Watford,
sure.
Where I live today. And the bookshop closed down. I was looking for other things to do. And I've been interested in family history for a while. I've been helping friends and colleagues to do their research. And I'd even done a couple of jobs for people sort of, you know, semi-professionally.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, yeah, let's give this a go. So back in 1984, I applied for an enterprise grant or something like that from the government and did that for about 2 or 3 years. And I think really, I think I was too young then really to take it seriously. I didn't really grasp what it was I was doing. So I learned quite a lot, but I went back into retail. I worked for Our Price Records as a manager of a store for a while. And that was a great life. Fantastic.
But mm-hmm. yeah.
Eventually I decided I'd go back to being a researcher again. I'd give it another go. And this time it was much more successful.
Okay.
I got to know lots of people and sort of got a bit of a name for myself. And then my family came along. I had a couple of children and I sort of thought I need something a little bit more solid. And this may sound strange, but this is, well, in 1999, I literally walked into the Family Records Centre, which had only been open for a year or so. And I spoke to the manager there and I said, "Have you got any jobs?" And 2 weeks later, I started working there. which seems strange now, but that was the way it happened. And I got a job there. I really enjoyed it. It was actually my dream job working there. I became the assistant manager of the National Archives side of things. Really, really enjoyed it. Made a lot of great friends there. And then, of course, they closed it down in 2008, I think. And we were all moved over to Kew, and I worked at Kew for a year and a half or so, and it wasn't really for me. The travel was difficult. It was difficult as well being a small fish in a big pond, really, there. There were lots of people who had interests, who wanted to do things a particular way, and it, I don't know, it didn't really work out for me. I left there, became a professional researcher for the third time, and the rest is family history, I suppose.
Would you have any advice maybe for someone who is perhaps planning their first visit to an archive or the National Archives?
The three golden rules are preparation, preparation, and preparation, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, you really need to know what's going to happen when you get there. What do I need to do in advance? Do I need to order documents in advance? What can I bring into the rooms with me? Can I take photographs of documents? Will that cost me money? All these sorts of things. You can't just turn up there and say, "I'd like to research my family history. Where do I start?" You know, you've really got to have an idea of what it is you're looking for, what you expect to find, and what you're going to do with that information when you find it. Because it's very easy to arrive at an archive, look at a document, find something interesting. Then you go home and you think, "I know what I should have done while I was there. Having just travelled 200 miles to get there and 200 miles back, I should have looked at this, this, and this." So think about in advance, really plan it and make sure you make the most of your time.
Did you ever get people turning up saying, "Oh, I'd like to see my family's family tree"?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yes, it's like you sort of, there used to be a joke, you know, you turn around and say, "Yes, just hold a second, we got it in this drawer over here," and you turn around and, you know.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice? Well, I'm going to say, wouldn't it be nice if it was as simple as that? But it wouldn't, because it's the journey, isn't it? Not the destination that's the good bit about family history research. You want to get there, but you want to go on the journey, definitely.
So you have a YouTube channel called Setting the Record Straight. What led you to create that?
Okay, digitization. I say right from the start, digitization is a great thing. It's fantastic. I couldn't do my job without Ancestry, Find My Past, The Genealogist, all these websites. They are wonderful in providing access to key sources. So
okay,
that's all a good thing. But I just think that sometimes, quite often, they don't really do it very well. They don't do it as well as they should do because, from a cynical view, they're in it to make money.
Yep.
That's what they're there for mainly. They're trying to make a profit. They're a business, and that's completely understandable. But that's not necessarily the best model to access archives. And I know in other countries, the government, through whatever channels, gets these documents scanned and makes them available free online. Mm-hmm. And that happens in lots of countries around the world. And so I think that the commercial model actually gets in the way of providing good access to documents sometimes, because they have this, to use the Woolworths phrase, the pile it high, sell it cheap model. And that doesn't necessarily tie in with quality access to archives. So what I started thinking, I'd been thinking this for years. I'd find something and I think, oh my God, what have they done here? You know, they don't seem to understand what they're doing. They don't seem to understand the structure of the documents and what the documents are actually there for. So I thought, rather than just trying to, I don't know, shout into the void and, you know, just that frustration, I thought, why don't I do something a little bit more constructive and just record short videos? I try to make them between 5 and 10 minutes, just about a particular point. In fact, I've got one that I'm working on, hopefully going to be releasing in the next couple of days or so. Just a very short single idea, either a look at something that one of the big commercial websites hasn't done very well, or
okay,
a look at a particular research strategy. So I've done ones about looking at particular places and trying to work out how they relate to the documents. And, you know, I'm always coming up with fresh ideas for it. I plan to do lots more.
Great. So I've certainly been eagerly awaiting the next one. So I will look out for the next one. What do you think is perhaps the biggest misconception about researching family history?
I guess nowadays it's that you can do it all online. I think that's the myth. And you can understand why the commercial companies, although they don't explicitly say that, kind of suggest it. They kind of suggest you just type in your name and out comes your family tree. And you know, as I've just said before, it wouldn't be nice if that was the case, because you want to do the journey, you want to do the research part of it. But I think the idea that it's easy as well, of course they're going to put across the idea that it's easy,
yeah,
but it's not. It's not easy. It's actually a very complex process proving that this document that you found relates to this person. There's nothing explicitly to say that it does. So you've got to do the work. And the idea that the commercial companies put across is that you find the name and that's it. That's your person. And it's very easy. You just click a link and suddenly they're your ancestor. And you've linked to someone else's tree who's researched the family back to the Norman Conquest. And what they haven't noticed is that their great-great-grandfather isn't actually the person they thought they were. So they've gone off on the wrong line that early. So I don't want to sound too cynical about it, because I don't feel cynical about it. I think family history research is great. And as I say, I think that what Ancestry and Find My Path have done in terms of providing access to documents is absolutely brilliant.
Yes.
But it's the way that they do it. And one of the things that really bugs me is the increasing emphasis, particularly on Ancestry, on user-generated family trees. You do a search for someone and the first lot of results that come up are not the documentary sources, the potential records that actually tell you about your ancestors, but what someone else has found. And then it's very difficult for a beginner not to see that thing that's at the top there, those family trees, as the truth.
Yeah, very easy just to click and accept and suddenly you're off on the wrong path.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can see the point of the companies, you know, they're commercial companies, they are able to provide the resources and the investment that maybe the government departments or policymakers might not want to stump up that would then make those records free for everyone to view.
Mm.
So I guess it's kind of like a fine line, a fine balance. But as you said, not everything is online. So those really juicy little documents, those letters, those diaries, those kind of things that you would find in an archive, I can't see that you would ever find them on a commercial genealogy company's website, because they're just not commercially viable.
No, exactly. Yeah. And the idea that everything will one day be digitized, I just think that's just not true. I can't see that happening.
Mm.
I think that we're always going to have this tip of the iceberg that's available online, but there's much, much more below the water that's out there.
How do you think or hope that the genealogy industry or community evolves in the next few years?
Well, I'd like to think that it would move towards more evidence-based research and to genealogy becoming a more respected discipline. But I do fear I do fear that the path we're going down is the click and add people to your tree route, and that that's not going to be beneficial in the long term.
Yeah, it's becoming too easy. It kind of ease over quality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And finally, what keeps you motivated with researching family history?
I think it's that every case is different. You might be looking at the same record sets time and time again, but you're going to discover different things. Every person is different. Every family is different. So it never feels boring. It really doesn't. I love doing the research. I love getting that email comes in, says, you know, interested in this. I'm trying to find my great grandfather. He seems to have disappeared. I think, great. This is wonderful. I love this. This is exactly what I want to do. So it's that Sherlock Holmes in me that, you know, wants to get to the truth and to dig deeper and to investigate these cases. I don't think I could ever find it boring. I've been doing it for, as you said at the start, for more than 40 years. And, you know, I would love to carry on doing it for as long as I can.
Whilst it can be fun to build a family tree covered in lots of names and dates, it's actually more fun to try to uncover those people's daily lives. Enriching your research in this way will expose you to some fascinating stories. And speaking of which, it's time for my guest to pick one of their most fascinating relatives and share their life story. So, Dave, who are you going to introduce us to?
Right, well, I am going to speak about someone who's very close to me. It's my grandma.
Okay.
This is my dad's mum, and she didn't do anything of groundbreaking international significance, and she didn't go on any amazing adventures or leave a detailed diary of her childhood, or she didn't get arrested as far as I know, or okay, anything like that. She was just a really important part of my childhood, and she's also responsible for one of the most important discoveries that I ever made as a family historian. So I want to share her life story.
Go for it.
Her name then was Margaret Howland. She was my dad's mum. She was born on the 9th of August 1906 at 46 Brunswick Street, Edinburgh, just off Leith Walk, for people who know that part of the city. She was illegitimate, as her Scottish birth certificate leaves no room for doubt on that. It actually gives her name, Margaret Howland, then underneath it says illegitimate. And that's the way that Scottish birth certificates were. Her mother was also called Margaret Howland, and she was a domestic servant. And that's how she's described on my grandma's birth certificate.
Right.
Now, when I first got interested in the family history research, I researched the Howland family quite extensively, and I discovered that they originated on the Isle of Man. And I've traced the family back about 8 or 9 generations to a man called Michael Howland, who was born on the Isle of Man about 1630, so a long way back.
Okay.
If you've ever used Isle of Man records in your research, you will know they are absolutely brilliant. They are really, really detailed. Women keep their maiden names, which obviously is very, very helpful.
Yes.
Almost every adult, married, singled, widowed, whatever, left some sort of will or testament.
Okay.
Almost everyone, even if they had hardly anything to leave, they had some sort of document of a testamentary nature. And the land records there are amazingly detailed, so you can trace ownership of land across a number of generations. So they really are wonderful records to work with. But Howland isn't a traditional Manx name, so they probably have deeper origins in another yet-to-be-discovered part of the country. So there's research for a future time. So my great-grandmother's father, Charles Howland, he moved from the Isle of Man initially to Islay off the west coast of Scotland, and then to Wanlock Head, which is the highest village in Scotland. They're very proud of that up there. And he worked there as a blacksmith at a lead mine. And Margaret was his second daughter. She was born at Ballygrant on Islay on 1st of December 1872. She was actually one of twins. She left home at a fairly early age and went into domestic service, made her way to Edinburgh. And there, I recently discovered, I only discovered this a couple of years ago, she gave birth to two illegitimate children, in one in 1900 and one in 1903, both of whom died very young.
Right.
That was just something I'd never known about. My grandma never mentioned that. And then in 1906, my grandma was born. And I've got loads of photos of her as a young girl, really amazing photos. And I know they're always dressed up in their finery in these photos, aren't they? And she's wearing all these white lacy dresses and she looks, you know, absolutely gorgeous little girl, really nice. But now that I know that her mother had lost two children already before that, I look at them a little bit differently and I sort of think that her daughter was really special to her. She was really precious and she wasn't going to lose another child. So you sort of think that in a way she almost looks a bit spoilt the way that she's dressed up and you know, this model little girl. But I think reading behind the lines now, there's probably that behind it. And so she lives in Edinburgh for a couple of years. And then in the summer of 1909, the two of them head off to Canada. They get on the SS Hesperian in Glasgow and they're bound for Montreal. And the intention apparently had been for them to settle in Canada. And they were headed for Winnipeg and they were going to live there.
Okay.
But for one reason or another, they didn't stay there. 10 months later, they made the return journey on board the SS Corsican, arriving at Liverpool and made their way back to Edinburgh. And I guess if they hadn't made their way back to Edinburgh, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. I'd have been, you know, it would have been a completely different history there. But so my grandma, she was very young, obviously, when she was there, only 2 or 3 years old, and she didn't have any clear memories of her time in Canada. But I remember her telling me once about that as a child, she used to have dreams about floating upstairs. And she couldn't understand these dreams. Why were they happening?
It's very odd.
She talked to her mum about it, and her mum worked out that she had this deep memory of escalators in Canada.
Ah, okay.
Which she hadn't seen. They weren't known in Edinburgh at the time. So I just remember her telling me this, that she said she had a dream about floating upstairs, and that was her one memory of Canada, and it's a very, very deep memory. But anyway, so they settled in Edinburgh, and I can trace them through various census returns, trade directories, electoral registers, living at various addresses around the city. And I also, as well as these photos of my grandma as a girl, I've got an amazing collection of photos of her as a young woman. And she worked as a milliner in Edinburgh, and I've got photos of her with her workmate, some of them taken at the foot of the Scott Monument in Edinburgh, very, very identifiable location there. But mostly what I have is this remarkable archive, really, of a young woman growing up in Edinburgh in the 1920s and 1930s. I've got these photos of her, you know, the ones you get with street photographers where they've just snapped these young women walking along the road. And
yes,
she's walking along, striding out confidently with this amazing coat, like a sort of real flapper sort of style, 1920s. She does seem to have been a bit of a rebel.
Right, yeah.
And in some of the photos, she sports this really, really sort of strong Eton crop hairstyle all over to one side like this, and really quite radical. She made her own clothes, and some of the dresses would probably have been considered a little bit, I don't know, should we say modern, but a little bit risque, certainly. And in a lot of the photos, she's there with some very fashionably dressed young men as well. But there's one man that starts to appear more and more in the photos, and he, of course, is my granddad, William Annell. And they become a couple, and then in September 1931, they get married. 2 years later, my dad was born, who turned out to be their only child. And so they lived in Edinburgh for a while in this tenement block in the south of Edinburgh, in fact, where my dad was born. And then in 1936, they moved out to a brand new house in the suburbs. And it wasn't actually a brand new house. I've got the original tenancy agreement that they signed in May 1936. As I said, my grandma was a hoarder. She kept everything that could possibly be seen as important. And this document also, it tells us that the house was going to be occupied by one adult male, so that's my granddad, two adult females, and one boy aged 3. My dad, he's actually only 2, but it says 3. So the second adult female who was in the house, as well as my grandma, was her mum. And they seem to have lived together for all their joint lives. So from the time that my grandma was born in 1906, right up to 1958, when my great-grandma died in that house in Edinburgh, they lived together. They must have shared so much of their lives. That's 52 years of living with the same person. And yet, she very rarely spoke about her.
Really?
It's interesting. My dad's still alive. He's now 90. And I've asked him recently about, what do you remember about your grandmother? And he says, not very much. You know, she lived in the house with him for 20 years. And she seemed to have just kept herself to herself. So I don't know. I'd love to know more about her. But so she dies in 1958, which is only a couple of years before I'm born as well. By then, my granddad had died. He died of a heart attack in May 1953. So I never got to know him. And imagine it must have been a terrible shock for my grandma to be suddenly on her own then. My dad was in his 20s and was actually working then and, you know, fairly independent. But she had to go out and find work, really, which can't have been easy for a woman at that time in her late 40s, I suppose. But she did find work. And by the mid-1960s, when I first really knew her, she was working in a large Edinburgh department store called Binns, for people who know remember that. And she was demonstrating the latest in knitting technology. She worked for this company called Knitmaster, who developed this electronic knitting machine. I've got photos of her using this machine. It's absolutely wonderful. And she became really proficient in using, they had punch cards, so little punch cards that you marked out the pattern. You put the card in, the knitting machine did its stuff. And and she loved it. She was in her element. I remember going in to see her in the department store, and she was the centre of attention, and I think she loved that all her life, being right at the centre of things. And she even started her own evening classes demonstrating how to use this knitting machine. So she was wonderful. She really was one of the most wonderful people that I've ever known. She was kind and funny. She was a bit scatty and absent-minded. I remember one incident where my dad was trying to change a light bulb. So he was standing up on the back of a chair, and my grandma was sitting on the chair in order to balance it so it didn't tip over.
Okay.
Of course, after a few seconds, she forgot what she was doing, stood up to get something. My dad went flat on his face. But that was the sort of person she was. She was wonderful, but just I don't know, the best grandmother you could hope for, really. And when I became interested in family history research, naturally, I wanted to speak to her about her memories, about what she knew. And of course, I wish now that I'd asked her a lot more than I did. But there was one subject that I steered clear of because, I don't know, I just didn't want to probe her about her illegitimate birth, about her origins, because, you know, people in of that generation didn't generally talk about things like that. It was all hushed up.
Kind of shameful.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought, I don't want to embarrass her. I don't want to ask her. So I'll just accept that that's a closed door to me, that that's something I won't ever find out about. And then one day in the mid-1980s, we were walking around a graveyard together, as you do. My wife was there as well. I've always been a huge amount of fun to be with, you know, this chosen day. Let's go to a graveyard, shall we, today?
Oh, lovely day out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we were looking for annal family gravestones. And very suddenly, completely out of the blue, my grandma said to me, "Did you know that I knew my father?"
Oh, okay.
And wow, it was an amazing moment. I can still feel that moment now. I went cold and really hot at the same time because I thought, this is huge. This is absolutely amazing. She's opening up. She's, you know, I don't know, all these secrets that she's held. And they suddenly came pouring out. She told me what she knew. She said that her mother had worked as a domestic servant for a man in Edinburgh, that this man's wife was disabled and that they were unable to have children. And, I mean, OK, my grandma was in her 80s and she was talking to her grandson in the 20s. So she's not going to go into too much sort of physical detail of this, but it was left for me to work out that she, my grandma, was the result of a relationship between her mother and her mother's employer.
Right.
And obviously, I don't know the nature of this relationship, but from what I've heard from her, it was a fairly as much as these things can be, a fairly good relationship, and he looked after them. He didn't just abandon them, and that's why when you see these photos of her in these beautiful clothes, they weren't just left to look after themselves. He did look after them. And,
okay, he's providing.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely. She told me that his name was Frederick Porter, that he was English, and that he worked for Cadbury's, and that he died somewhere in the south of England when she was a young girl. But she also told me that she'd often visited his house, that she'd been a part of his life and he'd been a part of her life. And she even took us to see the house in a little suburb called Davidson's Mains in Edinburgh. And she mentioned playing on the tennis courts behind the house, and there are still tennis courts there today. So she'd found the right house. And obviously the research that I've done now has basically proved that everything she told me was correct. He did die on the south coast. He was actually knocked off his bike by a bus in Brighton in 1916. And yes, he did work for Cadbury's. That was also true. And also DNA research now has linked me to relatives of his. So that absolutely was true. But one of the most difficult aspects of it all was that she'd never told my dad about this. And, you know, so her son, she'd never spoken to him about it. And it was difficult for me then when I eventually told him what I knew. It was difficult for him to accept that his mother had never told him. But yeah. I guess it was perhaps easier for her to tell me, someone a little bit more removed from it all than yeah. her son, who knew her mother and so on. Mm. So, of course, I mean, I wanted to research my new ancestors. And after my grandma died in 1990, I started looking in earnest. And initially, I got nowhere until I can remember this very moment. I picked a directory off a shelf at the Society of Genealogists, an Edinburgh directory from the early 1900s. And I was just thumbing through it, and I came across an entry for an F. Port, not Porter, but Port, who worked as a rep for Cadbury's.
Okay.
And there we were. I was soon up and running. This was the right person. It even gave an address for him in Davidson's Main. So, yep, this was the right person.
Bingo.
Yeah, exactly. And I can honestly say that no branch of my family has ever given me as much pleasure and indeed frustration as this particular branch of the family over the past 30 years or so, because he's provided me with the only English ancestors that I've got. My mum's family are entirely Irish and Lowland Scots. My dad's family are all from Orkney. So this is the only bit where I've got any English ancestry. And okay. I've traced the family back to the Oxfordshire village of Dorchester, which was actually where Midsummer Murders was filmed. It's a beautiful picture book sort of village.
Apart from all the murders,
yeah, I'm hoping they're all fictional. But as an English-based researcher, it's given me the opportunity to use English records that I work with every day in a professional capacity, but to use them for my own research. And they have proved an absolutely fascinating family. They owned in the 17th century what is now one of the oldest English pubs, the George Inn in Dorchester. They were involved in a chancery case that lasted for over 10 years. A cousin of the family became the printer of the Times newspaper, and he was even imprisoned in a fairly famous case for publishing a libelous article. In those days, it was the printer rather than the editor or the author of the article who was responsible, because they were the one who physically put it out there. But anyway, so he was involved in that. There's illegitimacy, there's inheritance dispute, there's loads of wills and deeds to investigate. I really couldn't ask for more. So if my grandma's given me nothing else, she's given me that part of her ancestry and my ancestry to research, and I thank her for that from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah, it sounds like that she has unlocked a whole load of research for you just by walking through that cemetery and saying, did you know?
Absolutely. And I think it was, I mean, I'm glad that I didn't push her, that I didn't probe her for that information, and that it came from her. I think she obviously trusted me, and she knew that I wouldn't use this information in any way that might negatively impact on her. And I developed that trust over years and years of talking to her and being a big part of her life.
Wow. And it's interesting when you said that her mother lived in the family home as well, but there's very little spoken about her, which is very curious.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, my dad's, as I said, he's 90 now, and his memory's not what it was. But I asked him quite recently again, you know, what do you remember about her? And it was basically nothing. Yeah, she's there in the photos. You know, she's a part of the family in the photos, and she's got a smile on her face. She looks like, you know, she's part of the family. She's enjoying herself. It was always the four of them. And in these photos, it's my granddad, my dad, my grandma, and her mum, the four of them working up on their allotment in Edinburgh and going out on day trips, photos of them in the meadows in Edinburgh. And she was clearly a really important part of the family. And she died the year before my older brother was born, so they're very close to having met, and yet I just didn't know about her until I started doing the research into the family. And what a life she must have led, you know, just bringing up that child on her own in Edinburgh from 1916, when Frederick died. My grandma's 10 years old then, and then the rest of the life she's then having to look after herself, because no one, there's not going to be any money coming from his family then. His widow's certainly not going to be providing for them, so she's got to look after herself after that.
And of course, you said that she'd had those two children previously, so
I know, yeah,
she's had to get herself through that. And then yes, you said that she's being supported by Mr. Port,
yeah,
but you know, she's still there by herself, so she must have been made of some pretty tough stuff.
Yeah. The second of those two children, by the way, is almost certainly Frederick's child as well.
Right, okay.
Because the I've got the birth certificate, and it gives where the child was born, but she, Margaret, signs the certificate as the informant, and the address that she gives in 1903 is the address that Frederick Port was living at. So I'm 99% certain. Also, she called a child Thomas. Frederick's father was called Thomas. It all adds up.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you very much for telling me about Margaret Howland. But I think it's now time for you to face
the brick wall.
Brick walls drive me mad. Yet somehow they also motivate me to continue researching. However, sometimes the challenge is tough, and regardless of how long you've been researching, you just need a little bit of help. With this in mind, it's time for my guest to share one of their brick walls in a hope that one of you, dear listeners, can help to solve it. Right, Dave, what have you got for us?
I always say that if you look at your family tree in a sort of pedigree style, every line that you've got, every branch of the family starts or ends, depending on which way we're looking at it as family historians, with a brick wall,
okay,
with someone whose parentage you don't know. And I also think, in a sort of slightly depressing way, every time you break down a brick wall and identify someone's origins, you instantly create two more, because you've now got their father and their mother that you don't know about. So brick walls, as you just said, they're what keeps us interested, aren't they? They're what makes the research fascinating and challenging.
It's true.
And the brick wall that I want to talk about is through my mum's Irish family. And anyone who's done any research in Ireland will know that it can get very difficult, yeah, to get beyond the early 19th century, really, particularly if your ancestors, like mine, were Irish Catholics. So I've got an ancestor called Thomas Flynn, who arrived in Edinburgh, not surprisingly perhaps, he arrived in Edinburgh in the late 1840s. So it's classic Irish famine time.
Yep.
He arrives in a part of Edinburgh, out in the west of Edinburgh, a little village, quite a developed part of Edinburgh now today, called Corstorphine. And there was a part of that of Corstorphine which was known as Irish Corner. And a lot of poor Irish people settled in that particular area, including my ancestors, the Flynns. So what do I know about the Flynns? I've got them in the 1851 census. We've got Thomas Flynn, and we've got his wife, Catherine, who must have arrived with him. And we've got their daughter, Mary, their son, John, who is my ancestor, another son, Michael, and a married daughter, Catherine. And they were all born in Ireland. So
right,
this is 1851. They're not in the 1841 census in Scotland. They must have just arrived in Ireland quite recently. So As far as John's concerned, I know what happened to him. I've traced his life, absolutely fascinating life, and I know what happened to him. And 10 years later, in the 1861 census, I've got Thomas and Catherine again. And they're still living in Corstorphine. They haven't moved very far. And we've got Thomas Flynn, he's 60, agricultural labourer, born in Ireland. We've got his wife, Catherine, 53. We've got their daughter, Mary, and we've got a granddaughter as well.
Okay.
And they're just living at an address where the address is given in the census as house. So it's not particularly useful, but I know pretty much where it was. It was in this part of Corstorphine near Irish Corner. And if you look down the page, you'll see there's a lot of other Irish people living nearby them. So I also know, thanks to the beauty of the 1855 registration in Scotland, the first year where civil registration was introduced, because Thomas and Catherine's son, John, had a daughter born that year in 1855, which tells me, and it's the only source I've got for this, it tells me that John came from County Roscommon in Ireland. Nothing else about the family gives me that clue. None of the censuses say anything other than Ireland, but this one item just tells me, yes, Roscommon.
Sure.
So I have spent a lot of time trying to research this family, trying to find them in Roscommon. I've got a few possible bites, little bits here and there that might relate to them. And they seem to come from Strokestown, which is today the home of, I think, the Irish Famine Museum. So we really are right at the heart of the Irish Famine. But I can't find a baptism for John. I can't find a baptism for any of the children, the siblings. I can't find a marriage for Thomas and Catherine. Thomas's wife Catherine's maiden name was Flynn. So we've got a Flynn marrying a Flynn. And in fact, right. John, okay. When John gets married in Edinburgh in the 1850s, he marries a woman called Bridget Flynn. So I've got a lot of Flynn ancestors. But I can't identify a record for Thomas, and perhaps that's not surprising. Perhaps I'm being too optimistic, thinking that I'm like to find things. But I know that people do find ancestors in Ireland, and I know that there are other sources to look at beyond the parish registers. There's the taxation records that record people, and I have found people who could be my Flynn ancestors in these records, but nothing to prove it. So that's frustrating, but I kind of accept that it's frustrating because Irish research, that comes with the territory, really.
Yeah.
But what is particularly annoying is that I've got Thomas and Catherine here in the 1861 census, and that's it. I have found nothing else about them. I can't imagine they went back to Ireland. It just doesn't seem very likely that they would do that. It's possible. But I can't find any record of them dying in Scotland. I can't find them in the 1871 census. I can't find any information that is definitively them about any of the siblings. So all I've got is John carrying on and his life very well documented in later records in Scotland. But Thomas and Catherine, what happened to them? I know Flynn can be spelt in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And there's also, this is a very interesting thing that I found a few years ago, that on, I think it's the baptism of one of John's sons in the Roman Catholic register in Scotland, it gives his name as Flynn, otherwise Igo. So there's a potential here that they've got a different surname. And again, the name Igo does come from this area around Strokestown. So that's it. In a nutshell, that is my issue. I would like to know what happened to Thomas and Catherine Flynn. I mean, the other possibility that I have explored vaguely is that they all went off to America. A lot of Irish people did. So they were in Scotland for a while, perhaps, and then they emigrated to America. But try finding a Thomas Flynn born in Ireland somewhere in America.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tough one. And it's interesting, you've got this window on them for just a couple of censuses, and then they've gone again. So you've got a missing bit beforehand, a missing bit afterwards, and just this little view of them for, what, 20-something years. So
yep.
It's very interesting. How are you seeing the Flynn spellings?
Well, normally, I mean, we would spell it F-L-Y-double-N, but we're finding it as F-L-I-double-N or F-L-I-N. I mean, it's always going to be starting FL and ending with an N.
Yes,
yeah. But it could have an E on the end. But, yeah, so you can use wildcards in your searches and you can produce all sorts of variants. But there's just this little confusion. I mean, obviously, I've tried looking for them under the name IGO as well. But, I mean, I've said the word IGO, and I'd be interested if the people listening to this, if they wrote down how you would spell IGO.
I think that it would be spelled IGOE.
Okay, that is certainly a common spelling of it. I think IGO is more common.
Okay,
but you know these people at that time, they wouldn't have been literate, so people are writing down the name for them. They're spelling it the way they're hearing it. So you've got Scottish clerks,
and they might not be that literate either.
They might not be, absolutely. Yeah, you just don't know. It's one of those things, if you're not in the room at the time, you can't possibly understand what was going on and why something's written down as it is.
Wow. Well, I hope that the listeners have been busily taking notes to see if we can find out where Thomas and Catherine came from, what happened to them, where did they go? And what's the best way for people to contact you if they think that they have a clue or a research idea?
Well, for a start, I would be enormously grateful if anyone was able to crack this problem and knew something about this family. It would be astonishing. And I wouldn't be at all professionally embarrassed about the fact that I hadn't found this and someone else had. I would just be grateful from the bottom of my heart. So you can email me at dave.annell@lifelinesresearch.co.uk. I'm very active on Twitter or X, or whatever we want to call it, at Dave_Lifelines. There's also my website, which is lifelinesresearch.co.uk.
Perfect. We'll, of course, put the links to all of those in the show notes for this episode. And listeners can head over to familyhistoriespodcast.com, where they can read this episode's show notes. Or they can send us an email at hello@familyhistoriespodcast.com, and we'll pass a message along straight to Dave. Now, whilst those listeners finish making those notes and scurry off to the archives, I think it's possible that I might just be able to help you solve this.
Excellent.
But you're going to need to follow me through to the garage.
Fantastic.
Here we are.
Wow. What on earth is all this?
This is my secret time machine.
It's very dusty.
Is it? Oh, well, think of it more like an insulating protective layer. But I can assure you that it is a fully operational, highly calibrated piece of scientific equipment.
Doesn't look very scientific. Look at this bit.
What about it?
Is this a bit of a knit master?
Bit of a knit master? Well, I mean, I can see why you think that, but any likeness is purely coincidental. It's science, Dave.
So, what are we really looking for?
No. This is it. Secret time machine. I thought you might like a little trip back in time to see if you can solve that brick wall for yourself.
Is it safe?
Well, I'd hardly put a Dave Annell in a time machine that wasn't safe, would I? Come on, take a seat and I'll prove it.
This one?
Yep, that's the one. So, remind me of the date and place you want to go back to.
Okay, so it's 1830, Stroketown, Roscommon.
1830. I'll leave it as the 14th of May, though. You'll need this. It's a temporal beacon. Keep it with you at all times, and then when you're ready to come home, just tap that big button on the top, and you'll be straight back here.
You're not coming with me?
No, the time machine never moves. It's just you. Oh, here we go. Dave Annell, thank you, goodbye, and good luck. 1830, check. Oh, no, hold on. Club 1830's holiday? 2008? Magaluf? Oh, no. The Family Histories podcast was presented and produced by me, Andrew Martin. My guest was the fantastic Dave Annell. And if you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave us a review or share it with your friends. Thank you for listening. Approximately no family historians were harmed in the making of this podcast.